Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Our case for argument today is 25-1812, BOS Selections versus Trump. Mr. Shumate, please proceed.
Chief Judge Moore, and may it please the court. Brett Shumate from the Department of Justice on behalf of the federal government. Congress has long given the president broad discretion to deal with complex and evolving national emergencies in light of his preeminent role in foreign affairs and national security. For decades, IEPA has been one of the most powerful tools that any president can use to protect our national security, our foreign policy, and our economy. To combat emergencies involving the flood of illegal drugs into the United States and the consequences of our exploding trade deficit, the president imposed tariffs under IEPA to put pressure on other countries to address the underlying...
But IEPA has rarely been used, hasn't it?
No, Your Honor. IEPA has
been over 50 years or so since it's been used.
Since 1977, it's often used by the president and the Treasury Department, for example, for OFAC sanctions and all kinds of license restrictions and transfers. The government uses IEPA all the time. IEPA, to be sure, has not been used for tariffs, but IEPA was enacted in 1977, 2 years after.
That's what we're concerned with here. When's the first time that IEPA was used for tariffs?
This is the first time IEPA has been used for tariffs.
But yet the statute's been in existence for over 50 years, correct?
Correct, but the statute here incorporates the exact same language.
Why is it? Has there been no national emergencies then in the 50 years?
There have been other national emergencies. There have been many national emergencies, but this is the first time IEPA has been used to address these types of emergencies. But I think the critical point is that IEPA incorporates the exact same language from the Trading with the Enemy Act that President Nixon used in 1971 to impose tariffs. And this court's predecessor in the Yoshida case in 1975 held that that language authorized tariffs. And I think, you know, that's an important decision, but I think the critical feature with Yoshida is that Congress was legislating against the backdrop of Yoshida in 1977 when it incorporated the exact same language. And we know that Congress was aware of that decision. It was referenced in the House report. So at a minimum, Congress was aware of Yoshida, understood that by incorporating that exact same language, it would be authorizing the president to use IEPA to impose tariffs.
What is your argument just on the statutory language of, I guess, 1702, putting aside Yoshida, that language would properly construed encompass tariffs as one of the tools?
So the phrase is regulate importation among 9 specific actions that the president can take, starting with investigate, all the way to prohibit or prevent. The phrase here that the president relied on is regulate importation. Tariffs regulate importation by controlling imports, by adjusting imports. The language here is similar to the language in Section 232C, which says adjust imports. And that language has always been understood to authorize, since Algonquin, to authorize license fees, and this court has upheld 232 tariffs using the language adjust imports. A tariff is similar to a license fee. It's a condition on import.
But
right?
I think the other side says, or they will say, that one of the reasons that it's not applicable is because Algonquin dealt with 232 references specifically duties, and that's not the case of IEPA.
So 232 does reference duties in another portion of the statute, but the language that the Supreme Court was interpreting in Algonquin was Section 232C, which has the phrase adjust imports. And the Supreme Court said adjust imports authorizes more than just quotas. It authorizes license fees. And you can think of a tariff as a license. It's a condition on importing the product or the good into the United States.
Coming back to the language of IEPA, is it your contention that regulate carries with it its plain and ordinary meaning to always include tariffs or taxing, and that when it's used throughout the United States Code, and I think you acknowledge it's used in a lot of ways in a lot of statutes that we wouldn't think are authorizing tariffs, that there's some other language in those statutes that tells us that regulate isn't carrying its full plain and ordinary meaning? Is the plain and ordinary meaning of regulate including the power to tax and tariff?
No, I think the word regulate takes its meaning from context, right? So FDA, when they're authorized to regulate drugs, they're not authorized in that situation to impose tariffs. But here, IEEPA says not just regulate, but regulate importation.
Counsel, when we look at the statute in which regulate appears, we see foreign exchange, payments, currency, and there's an old expression in the law, nositur a sokiki, you know it by its friends. Tariff seems to have no friends in that statute. So why would we read tariffs into that statute?
Well, Your Honor, I think you're referencing the language in 1702A1, right?
Yes.
Right, but that's not the language that the President relied on. He relied on 1702A1B, which has a string of a number of actions, starting with investigate, going all the way to prevent or prohibit. And so I think it's undisputed that IEEPA would clearly provide the President with the authority to prohibit all imports, say we're not going to allow any imports into the United States from China. Right? That is an extraordinary power, and that is a power that IEEPA expressly authorizes the President to take. And so the authority that the President invoked here is the power to regulate importation.
But that isn't what he's done. He hasn't blocked them. He has imposed tariffs.
Right. He has. And we know that Congress was aware of the Yoshida decision in 1977 when it adopted IEEPA and would have understood that by using this exact same phrase, regulate importation, Congress would have intended to authorize the President to take the exact same action that President Nixon took in 1971.
That's your problem, it seems to me, because the action that President Nixon took that was approved in Yoshida was much narrower than the action that's involved here. And you in your brief say, and you've said it this morning, that when Congress is aware of a decision, as it was with Yoshida, that the construction that was given is read into the statute. But the construction that was given is not a broad construction that permits upending the entire tariff schedule, which is the power that's claimed here. And the Customs Court in Yoshida expressed concern that that's exactly where the government's argument led. And the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals said, no, that's not, we're not saying that that's the breadth of the statute. In fact, it's not the breadth of the statute. So how do you deal with the fact that Yoshida itself seemed to give a narrower construction to the statute than you're giving to it now?
Well, I think Yoshida was interpreting a specific statute, right, the Trading with the Enemy Act. But the core holding of that decision, Yoshida 2, was that the phrase regulate importation authorizes tariffs, right? And so,
but not all tariffs.
But not all tariffs.
They would seem to be pretty clear about that.
But if you agree with me that the phrase regulate importation authorizes at least some tariffs, then we have to look to IEEPA, the statute the President relied on, and decide, did the President contravene any express limits in the statute? And he did not. Right? So section 1702A2...
Can I just, before you get to that point, which is important, I just want to get back. I think I understand your point about why in this statute regulates imposing a monetary penalty to reduce the amount, and how at least most, maybe even all of the other statutes that the parties have cited that use the term regulate are not about controlling amounts of things. So the context is quite different. But what about this? The statute says prevent or prohibit. Sometimes might it not be the case that Congress wants to give the delegatee a tough choice between really tough action and no action, because intermediate kinds of actions, and here I think tariff would be such a thing, are too easy. And why wouldn't that be something to take account of here?
I think it's important to understand the context in which Congress enacted IEEPA. It is a broad emergency statute. The nine actions that Congress outlined in Section 1702AB1 are extraordinary, right? They provide a number of overlapping authorities, and they authorize the President to take extraordinary action in the context of an emergency. Similar to what President Carter did during the Iran hostage crisis, he imposed asset transfers to block asset transfers to put pressure on Iran at that time. And so Congress wanted to provide broad and flexible authority in the context of emergencies, and I think you have to read the phrase regulate importation in the context of an extraordinary delegation of power to the president that can be checked by Congress in specific cases. If Congress finds that there's an abuse of IEPA or the national emergency.
That's not very realistic, because in order for Congress to act, the president would have to sign the legislation, and if the president claims the authority, is not likely to cabinet his own authority by signing legislation, and it's almost impossible to override a presidential veto.
I disagree, Your Honor. Just a few years ago, Congress terminated the COVID emergency. I mean, there were 68 votes in the Senate to terminate that emergency. Right? So there are a lot of longstanding emergencies, but Congress can act. And the way the statute is written, both Section 1703, 1706, and the Emergencies Act itself, it provides for extensive procedures for Congress to be involved in this process.
Counsel, would your argument be that at the time when Congress adopted this quite broad delegation of authority to the president, it was operating under the possibly then mistaken view, but the view nonetheless that they had concurrent power to override without a presidential veto, which is why they weren't worried about bestowing the broad power? It turns out they were wrong, but that doesn't affect the broad bestowing of power.
Correct. It doesn't affect the broad delegation of power. I think you're referencing Chadha, right? So when an IEPA was enacted, Congress itself could terminate a declaration of national emergency and suspend the president's power. After Chadha, that was no longer the case, but the statutes have been amended after the fact. And
just the National Emergency Act has been amended. This one hasn't, right?
Correct, but if Congress terminates a national emergency, it will terminate the president's ability to invoke IEPA, because IEPA depends on the national emergency.
And have there been cases in the Chadha line that say when certain powers were granted subject to an unconstitutional legislative veto provision, the power fails?
I don't know, Your Honor, but the statute has been amended to account for Chadha, and the process is still consultation with Congress, reports to Congress. Presumptively, the emergency only lasts 1 year, and Congress has a procedure to terminate national emergencies. All of that, I think, shows that there are checks on the president. If we can go back to the limits on the statute.
Before you go there, Counselor, one of the major concerns that I have is that IEPA doesn't even mention the word terrorist anywhere. And when Congress rewrote the TWA and came up with IEPA, it certainly was aware about terrorists. And correct, I mean, you can see that they were, and the United States possesses a highly structured regulatory statutory framework for trade matters. And I have 10 listed here, and I won't go through the list, but they all mention the word tariffs and duties. And you would agree with me that those statutes do pertain to tariffs, and there's no doubt about that, correct?
Correct.
But here, IEPA doesn't even say tariffs, doesn't even mention them.
I don't think that's unusual. I think there's at least two statutes I can point you to that don't use the word tariffs. Section 232C says adjust imports. Section 120.
What do you mean it's not unusual? It's not unusual in the trade framework, because it is very usual in the trade framework.
But there are other. Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I just meant to say there are at least two examples of statutes that authorize tariffs that don't use the word tariffs. Section 232C and 122, which authorizes the president to restrict imports.
But so aren't both of those in a part of the code that deals expressly with customs and duties, unlike IEPA, which is not in that chapter?
It is, and I think Yoshida has kind of directly addressed this point, where a similar argument was made in that case to the argument made in this case that, yes, there are a bunch of many specific tariff authorities, and those tariff authorities should govern over a specific emergency authority. Yoshida said at page 578, quote,
that was an issue when Yoshida was decided, correct? The mentioning of the word tariffs, or just including that. Why is it that when Congress wrote the IEPA and borrowed almost all the language it did from the TWA, why did it not recognize Yoshida in a way to include, to even mention the word tariffs or duties?
I think it didn't need to specifically use the word tariffs because it was writing that law 2 years after Yoshida had recognized that the phrase regulate importation authorized tariffs.
Okay, but your problem is that Yoshida didn't speak that broadly. The customs court there said the government's construction allows a wholesale rewriting of the tariff schedule. And Yoshida said, no, that's not true. It's cabined. It doesn't give that broad authority. And why is it that when Congress adopted AIPA, it didn't write against the construction that was given by the statute in Yoshida, which authorizes tariffs, but also is a limiting construction? Why do we accept part of the construction but not the other part of the construction?
You can take the whole holding of Yoshida, but I think you have to look to AIPA itself for the limits on the tariff authority. Sounds like we all agree the phrase regulate importation authorizes at least some tariffs. So then the question is, what are the limits on the president's tariff authority? Those limits have to come from AIPA itself, and the statute...
But here's the problem. I mean, you're saying... I mean, I don't think you're responding to Judge Stark's question. You want to use Yoshida to say that regulate as a term can include tariffs. But to do that, you have to, and let me preface it by saying, I don't think hypothetically, I don't think regulation in this context naturally would include tariffs. So I have to get there through some other way. And the way is ratification of Yoshida by Congress. But if we assume that Congress intended to ratify Yoshida, don't we have to assume that it intended to ratify its entire holding, which is that regulate doesn't mean unbounded authority to impose tariffs. It means bounded tariff authority within the confines of what it described there, and there were very specific facts about how some of these tariffs would not go above, I think, Schedule 2. Read Congress as incorporating all of that, not just the definition of regulate, but that regulate in this context means the power to impose limited tariffs within this framework, then does this executive order comply with that limited framework in Yoshida?
Yes, it does, because you have to find some law that the president violated to strike down the tariffs. On that hypothetical,
if it exceeds the definition of regulate as adopted by Congress from Yoshida. It's not just regulate equals tariffs. Regulate equals tariffs that are within the statutory framework already enacted by Congress. And I don't think those are true here for at least some of them. Maybe some of them are, but some of them are not.
But Congress enacted AIPA using the same language, right?
I don't think you're going out of line. You are not going to answer my question. So
I'm trying to identify what the limits would be that would constrain.
The limits are in Yoshida. Take that as the starting point. You accept that Yoshida itself, as a matter of reading that case, has limits on the authority to impose tariffs as part of regulation. And you read the case, and you see the context, which is President Nixon imposed some tariffs that went slightly above. But my understanding of the court's opinion, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that the court specifically looked at them and said, because a lot of these, there have been concessions before, none of the tariffs imposed went beyond the schedule that had already been enacted. And so that was the context in which they were allowing a presidential assertion of tariffs under AIPA within the already existing framework. They specifically said, we don't think regulate here means unbounded authority. And it seems to me you're asking for unbounded authority. Isn't that a problem?
President is not asking for unbounded authority, and I think you have to interpret
unbounded authority in the terms of the amount. Are you asking for unbounded authority in the terms of the percentages you can impose?
Well, there certainly is no cap.
Is there a yes or no answer to unbounded authority in terms of yes or no?
There is no limit on the cap of the tariff in AIPA itself. There are limits in AIPA, and I think
do not read Yoshida as suggesting that there should be a limit on the amount.
But I think.
No. I understand you don't agree with this way I'm looking at it. But if I think Congress ratified Yoshida, I think it ratified all of it. Particularly because it did say very, very little about Yoshida in the legislative history. It just noted it. It certainly didn't say, "Well, we agree that regulate means tariffs." all we're doing is relying on that canon of Congress intends to enact, you know, when they reenact it, intends to adopt judicial precedent. I don't see any precedent that says, well, we can parse it and say they intended to adopt this part of the case, but not this part of the case.
So I'm trying to answer the question. We take all of Yoshida, but the fact of the matter is the president didn't rely on the Trading with the Enemy Act. He relied on IEPA. IEPA against the backdrop of Yoshida, and IEPA itself has its own limits.
Well, I just want to add in, because we talked about legislative history a little bit, that the legislative history says Yoshida was a thin opinion. Did you read that part of legislative history? Are you aware of that part?
Yes.
Okay. And so it sounds like you're having Yoshida carry a lot of weight, but I think there are these portions of that history that really do take issue with Yoshida and potentially don't support its fully ratified.
But Congress would have understood when it used the exact same phrase, regulate importation in IEPA, against the backdrop of Yoshida, that it would be authorizing tariff authority in the president. And I think the question is then, what are the limits? Does this tariff authority,
so
these actions...
So what kinds of limits do you think are on IEPA? Why don't you tell us that?
Sure. So 1702B identifies four specific limits on IEPA authority. For example, the president can't regulate...
That doesn't have anything to do with the scope or duration of the tariffs. And you're just discarding the holding of Yoshida that you don't like. And the Customs Court said the effect of what the president is claiming here is to allow wholesale rewriting of the tariff schedules. And on appeal, the court said, no, that's not true. That's not what it does. And now you're saying, oh yes, we can do a wholesale rewriting of the tariff schedules. We can tack on 10% to every tariff that Congress has provided there. That's a wholesale rewriting of the tariff schedule. And I just don't see how you read Yoshida as authorizing that.
So Section 232 also doesn't have a cap on the tariff rate?
No, you're not answering my question. How is it that you can read Yoshida as authorizing that kind of wholesale rewriting of the tariff schedules?
Well, I think, so... Yoshida 578 said, quote, the existence of limited authority under certain trade acts does not preclude the execution of other broader authority under a National Emergency Powers Act, end quote. So what they were saying was, yes, there may be other tariff statutes that may also apply in the context of non-emergencies, but in the context of an emergency, the president can invoke that authority and he can invoke all of it subject to the limits in the emergency authority.
Can I ask?
At 583 in Yoshida, the court said, quote, the declaration of a national emergency is not a talisman enabling the president to rewrite the tariff schedules. And because that would be sound the death knell of the Constitution. So clearly, you know, I understand Yoshida is a critical part of your case, but as others have said, you have to buy all of Yoshida. And it seems pretty clear to me that Yoshida is telling us that no, the president doesn't have the authority to rewrite the tariff schedules. And it seems like in this case, that's what the president is trying to do.
Respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that the main point I can say in response is, yes, we can take all of Yoshida, but you have to interpret this statute and the limits on this statute. And is there any argument that the president violated or exceeded any limit in IEPA itself? There's not, because there are limits.
Then the next question is, maybe there needed to be a limit in IEPA that is lacking, because it's standardless in terms of what kind of guidance Congress gave or should have given to the president in terms of figuring out how far it could go in terms of imposing these types of tariffs.
I'm happy to talk about non-delegation. I'm sure we'll get there. But I think a dissatisfaction with the limits in IEPA itself is not a license for the court to impose its own limitations on the statute.
We haven't talked about Section 122,
yes,
the Trade Act of 74. And that has limits, time limits and amount of the tariff. And so why doesn't the specific Governor General, even if IEPA has some relevance to tariffs, 122 was more specific.
So in this area, Congress often enacts multiple overlapping statutes. And as I said earlier, when Yoshida addressed this point, there may be other specific tariff authorities that the president could...
We have this rule of interpretation in the law, the specific governs the general.
We also have a canon that you're supposed to interpret statutes so they fit together and that one doesn't supersede the other. And you can interpret 122 and IEPA to work together. This 122 says whenever. So whether it's an emergency or non-emergency, 122 is available. IEPA is only available in the context of an emergency. And you wouldn't read 122 to limit IEPA any more than you would read IEPA to limit Section 122.
I think
both
Judge Prost is next. I'm going to do some refereeing up here. Judge Prost is next.
I think you have thrown two different things maybe. One is whether or not it's unbounded, and the other is whether or not IEPA is limited to the limits that existed under Yoshida and those specific limitations in the statute. And I thought your answer that I gleaned in the briefs was that it's not unbounded or boundless because it requires a national emergency and extraordinary and unusual circumstances. And in that context, it seems like one could argue that Congress was acknowledging, and this House report reflects this, that we're giving broad authority because we're dealing in the known unknown. We're dealing with something extraordinary that maybe was unforeseen, that has maybe never happened before. And that's why you wouldn't necessarily want to be limited to something that happened before 1977.
That's correct. IEPA is an entirely different statute, uses the same phrases as before, but Congress intended to provide extraordinary power to the president in an emergency and has these checks in 1701.
But counsel, if you agree with those limits, are those limits judicially reviewable? And if they're not, are they really limits?
So we agree the limits in Section 1702 are reviewable, whether this regulates importation. We disagree that 1701 is reviewable, whether there's an emergency, whether there's an extraordinary threat.
So if they're not reviewable, how are they limits?
They're reviewable because the president himself is bound by law. The Congress itself can review the declaration of an emergency and terminate that. The president has to report to Congress. Congress has terminated emergencies in the past. So the fact that there's no judicial review doesn't mean the president isn't bound by the law.
Judge Hughes is next. Sorry.
So let me go back to regulation. And let's just let Yoshida talk aside entirely because I'm struggling with your answer because you seem to have been part of it, not part of it. So let's just go on IEPA without any background. And so what we're looking at is regulate in the context of this specific statute without any legislative history beyond just general stuff. Why would we assume that in this specific context, the Congress would have intended regulate to mean the power to tax? Regulate sometimes, but not only, includes the power to tax. And keeping in mind that tariffs have long been the function of Congress, and that, I mean, if we interpret it that broadly, I think we butt up against some major questions.
So we're not relying only on the word regulate, but regulate any importation, which is similar to adjusting imports, restricting imports as far back as Gibbons. The Supreme Court recognized the power to regulate commerce by imposition of duties. I think it's also...
those are things Congress did, not the executive.
And Congress delegates its tariff authority, its power to tariff, to the executive, and the question is whether IEPA is one of those statutes. Section 1702.
Sure, the Congress can, I'm sorry, I will let you answer, but Congress can also delegate the additional power to impose user fees and things like that that are along the lines of taxes. But you acknowledge that every time they use the word regulate, it doesn't include the power of the tax. So where's the dividing line on this use of regulate without looking at machine?
It's regulate importation, and one of the ways for centuries, countries have regulated importations by imposing a condition on the good and its access to into the United States by charging a fee.
Using the term regulate imports, Congress intended to give up its long-standing power to tax imports to the executive, admittedly under emergency circumstances, but that's what you think.
Yes, Congress has delegated a number of specific tariff authorities to the president. It's not surprising that Congress...
Sure, but when they have, almost every one of them uses the word tariffs or duties in some part of the statute. This is the only one I've seen where they have not used tariff or duty or tax or something like that.
They
just said regulate.
I don't think it should be surprising, though, that because this is an emergency statute, when Congress delegated the even more extraordinary power to block and prevent imports altogether, Congress would have also wanted to authorize the executive to also take the lesser measure of imposing a condition on import, which is essentially a license fee. And 1702A expressly authorizes licenses.
Mr. Chairman, I have some clarification questions, just real quick. My first question is, what is the government's view on what the threat is? Is it the trade deficit? Is it, I mean, that's what your brief suggests.
I think it depends on which emergency declaration we're talking about.
Not for the reciprocal tariffs.
So the first of all, the president identified a number of underlying causes that are contributing to the trade deficits, tariff barriers, a lack of reciprocity in our trading relationships, non-tariff barriers, all of which contributing to a spike in our trade deficit, which has reached a tipping point, and then the president identified the consequences of the trade deficit.
The consequences.
So the consequences are...
And then I have another question, just real quick. I don't see in the briefs where there was any attempt to distinguish between the various reciprocal or tariffing tariffs based on the varying amounts of those tariffs. Am I missing anything?
Well, you're not, because the plaintiffs don't challenge any of the rates, right? And they wouldn't have any basis to challenge the rates or ask the court to review the rates, because this court's precedent has been very clear, I think, that you don't review the president's rationale.
Okay, counsel, but what about the deals with? So you wanted to articulate four limits, and I want to give you a minute, and I'm hoping everybody will let you just get your four limits out before somebody interrupts you, because I think deals with is one of them, and I think that might provide us with the authority to have some very deferential review. Like, you know, if the president says there's a problem with our military readiness and he puts a 20% tax on coffee, that doesn't seem to necessarily deal with unless he links it up somehow. You understand? So can you address that quickly for me?
Sure. So our initial position is that 1701 is not reviewable at all. That's where
yeah, but get past that.
Even if it were reviewable, it would have to be extraordinarily deferential to the president. And sure, in an extraordinary case.
Answer my questions.
So these tariffs deal with the emergencies by giving the president leverage in the same way that President Carter.
So you think this is a bargaining chip like Dames and Moore?
Exactly.
But even on the reciprocal tariffs, you think it's a bargaining chip?
Yes, the president just negotiated trade deals with the European Union using the tariffs as leverage to negotiate trade deals that address the emergency that he identified. It's just like what President Carter did.
But that would read deals without.
No, it wouldn't. It would.
What's how is deals with still a meaningful limitation on presidential power?
Because it gives the president leverage to address the emergency through leverage, through negotiating with our trading partners. And that's what the president did here with the drug trafficking tariffs and what he's doing with respect to the reciprocal tariffs. And I don't think the plaintiffs are challenging the reciprocal tariffs and whether they deal with the
I know, but I was suggesting maybe they could.
Maybe they could, but the reciprocal tariffs directly deal with the emergency of the trade deficit by imposing tariffs to reduce imports and directly address the trade deficit. So that's not challenging.
Can a trade deficit be a extraordinary and unusual threat when we've had trade deficits for decades?
Well, the president identified a severe spike in the trading deficit over the last 4 years that have caused, essentially, it's reached a tipping point, right? It's affecting our military readiness. It's affecting our domestic manufacturing capabilities. So yes, absolutely.
But we can't look at that. We can't decide whether that makes sense or whether it's supported by the record or by the existence of what the president says is a national emergency.
No, because 1701 delegates to the president discretionary choices, and the Supreme Court has been very clear in cases like Dalton versus Specter that, quote, how the president...
How does that solve a non-delegation problem when there's no judicial role?
So I'm happy to address non-delegation doctrine. So even taking the intelligible principle test on its own terms, the Congress here in IEPA identified the general policy.
What can we do as a court to cabin the president's authority under the statute if everything that he does is non-reviewable?
You can check whether the president complied with Section 1702, which is what we've been discussing today, whether he acted within the scope of his delegated authority in imposing tariffs. When it comes to his...
What does that mean? I don't understand.
Whether the statute authorizes tariffs. The key statutory question...
You say it does. It authorizes any kind of tariffs that he wants.
And I think the court can review that question under the clear misconstruction standard. But when it comes to the president's rationale,
in order to have an enforceable standard, we should limit the scope of his tariff authority.
Well, there is an enforceable standard, Section 1702, and there are limits on that authority under the non-delegation doctrine. 1702B identifies four specific limits. The fact that those limits may not be satisfying doesn't give the court a reason to identify or come up with extra textual limits on the president's tariff authority. Those are the limits in the statute.
You never told us what you're for. Quick, rattle them off. What are your four?
So 1701 has a number of limits. Has to be a national...
Four, precisely. What are they?
National emergency. Has to be an extraordinary and unusual threat. Has to emanate from outside the United States. It has to deal with the national emergency. Those are the four limits in Section 1701.
Why would the president rely or utilize all the other trade relief statutes that are in the books right now? Section 338 of the Tariff Act. Section 232, which authorizes the imposition of additional duties. Section 122, Section 201, cases that have come before this court that authorizes the president tariff authority to a duty or tariff rate quotas. Section 301 of the Trade Act of 74. Section 731 of the Tariff Act of 1930. Section 107 of the Trade Act. Section 505 of the Trade Act of 74. All of these are, and I'm sure you would agree with me on this, but all of these are trade relief statutes, correct?
Correct.
They're designed to ameliorate or to repair some sort of damage that's been done to the U.S. economy because of imports, correct?
Correct.
And all these statutes are directed to imports, and they have a beginning and end. Some have very complicated, highly technical, investigative regulations. Is that right?
Correct. I think.
So why would the president ever rely on all of these trade statutes if he has under IEPA this unbounded power?
Because IEPA has its own limits, right? And even just yesterday,
limits.
There's has to be a national emergency, right? Has to be an extraordinary and unusual threat. And IEPA is not going to be sufficient to address every trade situation. Just yesterday,
did you get all your limits out? Were there any others you
wanted to add? We covered the 1701 limits. We covered the 1702B limits, the four limits there. The same argument I think was made in Yoshida that yes, there were other specific tariff authorities that President Nixon could have relied on, but the court said the president can.
Those statutes had meets and bounds. They impose safeguards on the president. How long an action can take? How far an investigation? Proving material injury to a U.S. Manufacturing sector. All of those are now dislocated. If we adopt your argument dislocates that entire U.S. trade relief framework that I just called out on.
Not at all, Your Honor. Even just yesterday, the president signed a new 232 order with respect to copper.
But do you see the difference between an anti-dumping action and the type of procedures that are built into place, the safeguards are built into place, allowing all parties to comment and enduring and looking at whether there's been a certain burden of proof that has been met? None of that is in IEPA.
And
why is IEPA a trade relief statute?
Because in emergencies, Congress wanted to give the president extraordinary authority to protect the United States, its national security and foreign policy. And all of those tariff statutes are...
One last point here. Are you familiar with the GSP system, Generalized System of Preferences?
I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay.
That too is a
trade relief statute. And it's a process whereby the United States recognizes lesser developing economies. And it allows us lesser developing economies to maintain a higher tariff rate than what we impose against them. And so only Congress can amend and renew that GSP system. Seems to me that this is another trade relief statute that IEPA would dislocate if we were to adopt your argument.
Well, just to answer that point, Your Honor, all of those statutes remain valid and available to the president, but in its wisdom, Congress understood that in an emergency, the president may not have the time to go through all the procedures and have a rulemaking process and have an investigation to address an extraordinary threat to the United States.
We're going to hear from Judge Cunningham. You can answer that, and then we want to turn to the appellees.
So instead of trade deficits, let's say the emergency is the U.S. has a large budget deficit. What, if anything, constrains the president's ability under IEPA to declare the budget deficit an unusual and extraordinary threat?
Well, I think 1701 requires the threat to have a source outside the United States. It's not clear to me that a budget deficit would satisfy 1701. And then 1702A1B also requires that a foreign national have an interest in the property. So it just doesn't seem like IEPA would be available in that type of situation, Your Honor.
Okay. We'll save the rest of your time for rebuttal, and let's hear from Mr. Katyal.
Thank you, Chief Judge Moore, and may it please the Court. You just heard an argument in responses to Judges Hughes, Stark, and Dyke that our federal courts are powerless, that the president can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, for as long as he wants, so long as he declares an emergency. That is as major a question as it gets, a breathtaking claim to power that no president has asserted in 200 years, and the consequences are staggering.
I understand why you'd want to start there, but that might not be the way I, for example, view my role in reviewing the four limits that Mr. Shumate mentioned. So could you address if we perceive ourselves as having some ability to review deals with extraordinary and unusual threat, what standard ought we to use for that? And how detailed a review do you think I get to
take? So we think they would still lose if there were some detailed review. Obviously, you heard him pushing away. You gave him chance after chance to say, hey, are any of these limits judicially enforceable?
Answer my question.
Yes. So we think that if you started to review, as he said, you'd review the 1702 limits, including unusual and extraordinary threat. And if so, they would lose every day of the week. This is the antithesis. IEEPA has a freestanding requirement of an unusual and extraordinary threat in the statute. And unusual, as our brief explains, using dictionary definitions.
Can I jump in, just because the following is one way of thinking about it that I'd like to get your answer to. So, and this has to do with the difference between a balance of trade and goods and a balance of payments and different kinds of consequences that a simple difference in a negative balance of trade and goods, more imports than exports, can cause. All by itself, as your own amici say, a negative balance of trade and goods is neither bad nor good, just inconsequential until you specify the consequences. So one needs to know what the consequences are. Some kinds of consequences might be monetary, and we start calling those balance of payments because there are other factors that go into the accounting category of balance of payments. The reciprocal tariff executive order doesn't mention balance of payments. That should be obviously one reason that 122 might not apply, but that's not what I want to get to now. This executive order says there are five or six related consequences of a negative balance of trade in goods. I'm going to summarize them as severe deficiencies in our manufacturing capacity.
Yeah.
As I read, and that's what would have to be unusual and extraordinary, as I read your argument here and below, the only thing you said about why we have something usual and ordinary is that negative balance of trade, a negative balance of trade in goods, is decades and decades old. I don't see you having said anything at all about the usualness or ordinariness of the manufacturing deficiencies that are, in fact, itemized in the EO. That's what I want to get your
Thank response. You. So first, let me talk about Chief Judge Moore's question about the standard of review and then get to the specific question about balance of payments.
Maybe the standard of review doesn't matter if you haven't...
I understand that, but Chief Judge Moore, we do think that Congress imposed a freestanding requirement about unusual and extraordinary, unlike, for example, their argument about emergency declarations, which are things that are committed to the president. And so there may be discretion there, but this is a freestanding thing, which there is no discretion to whatsoever. They cite no precedent that says they get discretion in that circumstance. Now, on your question about balance of payments,
forget about the balance of payments. That goes to 122. I don't want to talk about 122 right now. You probably get there. I want to talk about the difference between a negative balance of trade in goods and the consequences that may or may not occur. This executive order itemizes five or six consequences, and I do not see that you have made a case that those consequences are anything but...
I think we have. We've taken the president at his word, in which he says, first, that the trade deficit is large and persistent, and then second, the consequences of that trade deficit, he says, are the diminishing of the manufacturing base and the like. And we're not asking you to second guess the president here. We're just saying, take that exactly as a given. That's exactly what, trade deficits, operate under the historical norm. He says, well, it spiked. It spiked by 40%, he says. That's not inflation adjusted.
Things can build to a tipping point, right? It's like going bankrupt gradually, then suddenly. Suddenly there are these deficiencies in manufacturing.
Yeah.
And I don't see manufacturing capacity, and I don't see that you have made any case. And I will say, do you agree that in the procedural posture here, if we got to the point of thinking that it was wrong to grant you summary judgment, we would remand for you to be able to address, for example, the kind of issue I'm now talking about?
I think we would, but I really don't think you need to get there whatsoever. That is, you know, the president's executive order isolates the trade deficit and those consequences as persistent for half century. And I do think and I think the whole point of the requirement, Judge Toronto, is in circumstances in which Congress can't act, in which you have an emergency crisis, then of course the president has some broad leeway. That's what, as Judge Dyke was pointing to, Yoshida was about. But it was limited in all those ways. Here he's coming in saying, well, I can declare a, you know, slow boil kind of emergency or something like that. That isn't the point of what IEPA is about or the TWIA or the predecessor statute of TWIA. More importantly, I think, and this goes to something that Judge Reyna was saying earlier, we're talking about a statute that doesn't mention tariffs whatsoever
before my colleagues get in. We've talked a lot about what regulation of importation means. We've talked about what it doesn't mean, i.e., arguably tariffs. What does it mean? What does it do?
Yeah, so I think it permits quotas, like limiting on the number of goods, licensing requirements.
Does it include licensing fees?
Well, licensing fees, I think, are a more complicated thing. The one thing that I think it excludes for sure is tariffs, because historically that is something that our founders committed to the Congress. And as Judge Reyna was pointing out, every single time Congress has given the president tariff authority, they've done so expressly with words. He says Section 122 didn't use the words. Of course not. It says, quote, in the form of duties. He says Section 232 doesn't use those words. Of course not. It refers to duties specifically in the statute.
Okay, so can we get back to what WCWT does? So you said fees, but not license fees. You said quotas.
Yeah, so
wouldn't quotas come under prevent or prohibit? I mean, a lot of verbs in subsection B.
It would be a lesser thing, so you could don't have to restrict all of them. And he said, well, the president's power to blockade is a greater power than the power to tariff. Absolutely not. And this is what Gibbons versus Ogden is all about. The whole idea is that tariffs and arts and taxation are always tempting for kings and for presidents. And so that's why that power was located in Congress. And every single time Congress has departed and given that power to the president, they've done so clearly. And here,
What about Algonquin? It said Algonquin said adjust imports.
And adjust imports, but then it says duties.
That includes taxes.
Yeah, that's their best case, and boy, it's a terrible case for them.
Well, maybe their best case is Yoshida.
Well, on Algonquin itself. That's a case in which the statute itself said duties, unlike this one, there's a legislative history that says we're all about giving the president such powers over tariffs. Nothing like that here whatsoever. His one reference in the legislative history to Yoshida is thin at best and doesn't say anything about them approving the prior authority. Now, you said Yoshida is their best case. I think, as Judge Dyke pointed out, you know, if you want to live by the sword of Yoshida, you're going to die by the sword of Yoshida. Yoshida has very, very strong limits on the use of the tariff power, and in particular, I point to...
When you use the word limit, can you distinguish between limits that were in the proclamation that contributed to the upholding and anything in Yoshida? I'm not sure there is anything that says these limits are necessary to our holding, and in the absence of them, we would hold differently.
Yes, so first let me start at 583, in which Yoshida said it, quote, wasn't approving in advance any future surcharge of a different nature or sanctioning the exercise of an unlimited power which would strike a blow to our Constitution. And then there are three specific limits in the opinion. One, that Nixon put a ceiling on the tariffs at, quote, the rate prescribed by Congress. It didn't supplant the entire tariff scheme of Congress. That's at 577 and 578. Second, that it was a temporary measure at 572 and 578, meaning they would, quote, end, and they said it was very important that Nixon announced those ex ante in advance that it was a temporary measure. That's unlike here. And third, that the tariffs didn't apply to all imports, but only those goods already subject to the tariffs. That's at pages 577 and 568. And so the court said, quote, far from attempting to tear down or supplant the entire tariff scheme of Congress, the president imposed a limited surcharge as a temporary measure calculated to help meet a particular emergency and not imposed to raise revenue.
What if none of those statements in Yoshida had anything to do with interpreting the term regulate, and all of those statements were directed to the constitutionality of President Nixon's proclamation, which is a different question than the whole exercise of trying to understand what does regulate mean?
Either way, if his argument is that they ratified Yoshida, then they ratified all of those limits, whether you call them constitutional or not, that's what Congress had in mind. We think this whole thing is bogus. The idea that Congress ratified Yoshida, a one-panel decision of this court, that they had awareness of it in a statute in which they copied 76 words from the predecessor statute, TWIA. I mean, one of the predicates of statutory ratification is that the statutory landscape hasn't changed. As Judge Reyna was saying, it changed massively in 1974 with the enactment of Section 122, which is a statute to deal specifically with this. That's what Yoshida even says at footnote 33. It says Section 122 is the way to deal with large and serious trade deficits. So I think all of that says the other thing. It says that the government would lose. The other point to make here is that if the government is right, then they're going to run surely afoul of the major questions doctrine, because the very same arguments you heard my friend make on the other side, that you can smush into the words regulate importation, the power over tariffs, is exactly what the president has been saying and the Solicitor General time and again.
I know you want us to say that regulate doesn't include tariffs, and I think you have some pretty good points on that. But if we assume that the only way you get tariffs into regulate here is through Yoshida, then, and we assume that they have to adopt all of the Yoshida, not just the definitional aspect, then do we need to even reach the broader question? Because I didn't hear any argument from the other side that the tariffs under either the reciprocal tariffs or the fentanyl tariffs met what were the clearly expressed boundaries in Yoshida.
Absolutely. I think you wouldn't have to reach them. You could reaffirm what the CIT did there. Absolutely. My point to you is, if for whatever reason you didn't buy the idea that there are limits on Yoshida, that Section 122 isn't the way to do that, then you'd reach that broader question. Does IEPA authorize the regulation of the imposition of tariffs at all? And the real problem they face there is the major questions doctrine, because in Biden versus Nebraska, the government said a statute that gave the president power to, quote, waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision. They said, well, that obviously includes cancellation of student loans. The court said, no way, quote, minor changes are okay, but you can't unilaterally define every aspect of federal student financial aid. Same thing with Alabama Realtors. The statute said, quote, the government can make and enforce regulations to prevent communicable disease. Of course you could have fit into there the eviction moratorium.
The meaning of regulate. Could you respond to the government's argument that we kind of know from context when regulate includes the power to tax and when it doesn't?
Yeah, Judge Sirk, we are all about context. The context of no trade law in 200 plus years that has been interpreted to give the president this power, as Judge Lurie was saying, this statute has no friends. Second, the context of every statute that gives the president the power to tariff that expressly says so, that's Judge Reyna's point. The context of the Constitution itself, which distinguishes.
What do you make of the argument, if I understand it correctly, that say in the FDA Act, where the FDA is given authority to regulate, if I understand the government, they're saying the FDA, at that point in the statutory scheme, can impose taxes because it can regulate, but something else about the context of the FDA Act reads out that power.
Yeah, as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce brief points out, what in the world context are they talking about? Take, for example, the SEC. The statute that gives the commission the power in 78K to, quote, regulate transactions on exchanges. Just like IEPA, to regulate importation, regulate transactions on exchanges. If this argument's true, every single time you and I sell a stock, the SEC can tax it.
So there's nothing in the textual language of the SEC Act that would read out that power?
Nothing. nothing that they can point to, and there's nothing in IEEPA, by the way, that suggests that the president would have the power to regulate tariffs or taxation. The best he's got is this legislative history. I mean, it's been commonly said that legislative history is looking out at a crowd to pick out your friends. Here, they can't even find any friends to wave back. I mean, it is the most minor reference imaginable, and it certainly doesn't meet what this court has used as its threshold for the statutory ratification doctrine, which is a judicial consensus or something like that, or as the court, Judge Jike's concurring opinion in Arellano versus McDonough said, you know, which was a concentrated venue case, that, quote, we are dealing with the decision of a single circuit court which has not been reviewed by the Supreme Court, and in that opinion, you said the statutory ratification doctrine prerequisites were not met. More importantly, Judge Stark, if the government's argument's right, they've got to overcome the major questions doctrine. This is, they are asserting a sweeping of power as one imaginable, with, as Chief Judge Moore pointed out, all no judicial limits. You know, if the government is going to have that power, then Congress has to give it to them clearly. I mean, this is not an elephant in a mouse hole. This is a galaxy in a keyhole.
The term regulate can sometimes include tariffs. There are at least two statutes, one involved in the Supreme Court decision in Hampton, and then another in the Tariff Act of 1930, where Congress conferred the power to regulate and then made clear that that included the power to impose tariffs. So regulation doesn't necessarily exclude tariffs. I gather your point is that there has to be something explicit in the statute that says regulate in this context means tariffs.
Your Honor, I'm aware of any case, any decision that says the word regulate includes tariffs. There are
two statutes that say you can regulate by imposing tariffs.
But they actually specifically give the power to tariff in those two statutes.
Yes.
And so, you know, there are many cases that say that the power to tax includes the power to regulate, but there are no reverse cases that say the power to regulate includes the power to tax. And as Gibbons versus Ogden points out, these are two fundamentally distinct.
The problem is Hampton says that the tariffs can have a dual purpose. They can be a tax, but they can also be designed to regulate. And,
right.
And that's the whole point of the Hampton case. It can be that tariffs have a regulatory component to it, but if that's going to be the case, then you would expect Congress to make some reference to tariffs, and because this statute doesn't do that, they resort to the Yoshida and say, oh, well, Congress legislated against the background of Yoshida, but as we've discussed, it would seem as though if they're going to take one part of Yoshida, they have to take the other part as well.
That's exactly right. That's all you need to do here is to say exactly what you said. I do think that a further argument for those members of the court who aren't interested in that line of thinking, there's two other points, which is the IEEPA doesn't authorize the regulation of tariffs at all, or if it does, Section 122, and this, Judge Hughes, is what you were getting at earlier, Section 122 is the way in which the government has to deal with this.
This seems to me to be a question of the trade lexicon, the language that people in the trading community use. You never refer, or I've never heard reference to a tariff being regulated, meaning that you impose a tariff. You use the word, you impose a tariff, you assign a tariff, you do different things like that, but what you don't do is regulate. Regulate, to me, seems to be more about dealing with the procedural apparatus that surrounds the imposition of a tariff. But either way you look at it, it doesn't mean create a tariff.
Right.
So imposing a tariff is much different than creating a tariff.
100%, and of course hesitant to ever engage with you on trade law, but absolutely, you're 100% right. There's a difference between regulation and imposition of the tariff in the first place, which is why no president, as you started out today's argument, no president has ever read IEEPA this way. Now, for those of you who disagree and think that, you know, Section 122 is the issue, I want to go back to Judge Toronto's question about balance
of
payments.
Just to be clear, so you agree that regulate tariff could mean, for example, require a certificate of origin upon importation.
For the words regulate tariff, of course, right. Here the word regulate importation,
license,
I'm not sure.
Require a license for the importation of certain hazardous goods.
Sure, if you know, in those circumstances, those aren't tariffs, and you know, the president isn't imposing them as such. Here, as this case comes to the court, it's common ground that this is a tariff. Judge Toronto asked about the words balance of payments before in Section 122. Notably, the government is not making the argument that balance of payments is different than trade deficits at the reply brief at page 2. I think they equate the two.
The reply brief but at page 13 to 14, they make the assertion. It's not elaborated, but they make the
It's very unclear to me. And
don't talk over me.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry.
They do not do this in their opening brief. They make broad assertions because they're after broader, bigger game about how IEPA can overlap even where 122 applies. We are sometimes in the business of looking to avoid deciding bigger questions and looking at narrower, specific questions. So it seemed to me worth exploring whether, in fact, 14257 is actually about balance of payments, and it seems to me there's some reason to think not.
Yeah, so I do think page 2 takes back part of what they say page 13, and I suspect the reason is the government's out there, and including cited in our brief, example after example of them saying, we have the 122 power, don't worry about IEPA. So I think they want to have this 122 power. Now, if you got into the question you're asking, I don't think that there's a difference between balance of payments and trade deficits. That is the largest component of the balance of payments is the trade deficit problem. That's what the CIT says at pages 34 and 35 of its opinion. The Department of Commerce actually keeps track of this from 1922 on. They've had a ledger, and the first entry in that ledger is the exports or the debits, and the debits, and that's the imports coming into the country. And then the first entry on the other side is the exports coming in, and it is the biggest component of it. As the CIT...
Part of it is a linguistic point about balance of payments and balance of trade. Part of it is I call it a more substantive point. You have to, if there's going to be a threat to the economy, you have to say what concrete problem there is. 122 is all about, as the 1971 proclamation was all about, monetary problems, exchange rates, reserves. This executive order is not about that at all. It's about a different set of problems, never mind the label, namely manufacturing deficiency. I'm just going to use that as the shorthand. So 122 doesn't address that at all. So even if it's exclusive in its 15% 150 days for the problem it was addressing, why would it be exclusive for this problem?
So Judge Toronto, four responses. First, it doesn't make any sense to think currency is different. The trade deficits lead to currency depreciation, so they're part of the same problem. Second, the legislative history of 122 says that Congress was worried about trade deficits, and the oil trade in particular, and the massive trade deficit from $7 billion to $70 billion. That's at the Senate report, page 88. Third, Section 122 has a separate provision to deal with the currency problems you're talking about. The balance of payments occurs in a totally separate provision, so I think it'd be wrong to read Section 122 as only about currency. And fourth, if for whatever reason you disagreed with me, remember the Trump executive order here refers to, quote, currency practices and their associated market distortions that boost exports to the United States. So even if you thought Section 122 is about currency, that's what he's invoking here as the problem. We do think that the unusual and extraordinary threat language isn't met here because the president has himself called exactly this problem persistent. Every year, he says, for the last half century, something that's been that persistent is the opposite of what's unusual. And while the court, you know,
I just want to ask about the major questions doctrine again, I'm sorry, about the clear congressional authority. Assuming we were to conclude that there was legislative ratification by Congress of Yoshida's interpretation of regulate importation, because we don't need to presume or inquire into a presumption of whether they knew about Yoshida, it's quite clear that they did in the House committee report, then would the legislative ratification there be enough of a clear congressional authority?
I don't think so. So the Supreme Court in Utility Air Group had a similar case in which the Solicitor General said those ratifications, statutory ratification and the like. And what the court said was, no, you still need a major, you still need clear express authorization when you are asserting such a sweeping power, one that no president has saw before in the particular statute. And so here we think it would overwhelm, the major questions doctrine would overwhelm any kind of statutory ratification argument, as with the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, because as the Learning Resources case pointed out, if you adopt their view of regulation, then Congress has adopted a statute which is unconstitutional on its face, that it would permit the president to regulate export taxes, and that is something that is obviously unconstitutional. So their interpretation gives the very same word, regulate, two different meanings in the same phrase of the very same statute. So that's another reason why I think this ratification doctrine, not just that the prerequisites not met, but the, their
okay,
their statutory interpretations.
Thank you. We're going to hear from the states now.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Oregon Solicitor General Benjamin Gutman. Defendants can't maintain that Congress intended to codify Yoshida into IEEPA and then ignore the parts of Yoshida that directly refute their arguments. So I'd like to start by talking about why, assuming that Yoshida is the governing standard for IEEPA, both the reciprocal and the trafficking tariffs exceed what IEEPA allows. And then, if time permitting, circle back to maybe why IEEPA doesn't allow tariffs at all. So starting with the reciprocal tariffs, the key question is how IEEPA and Section 122 fit together. And the answer is that the specific governs the general. Section 122 gives authority for tariffs to deal with large and serious balance of payments deficits, but it puts limits on those tariffs. And IEEPA's general authority to regulate importation doesn't allow the president to defy Section 122's specific limits. That's exactly what IEEPA said.
Congress could have had in mind that the president has more authority in unusual. You said 122 deals with long and serious.
Large and serious.
Large and serious. And the National Emergency Act and IEEPA deal with unusual and extraordinary circumstances. You don't think that Congress could have conceived that the president ought to have more authority in IEEPA? In unusual circumstances, rather than just when they're long and serious, large and serious?
If a large and serious trade deficit is an emergency, it's an emergency that that Section 122 directly addresses and covers and sets limits for. I think the federal government is misreading the part of IEEPA, the part of Yoshida on page 578 that discusses emergency and non-emergency powers. What it's talking about, it uses the term foreseeable and non-foreseeable issues, that Congress has enacted specific authorities to deal with foreseeable issues and left, in that case, TWIA to deal with, issues that were not foreseeable. Section 122 shows that not only is this a foreseeable issue, but it's one that Congress has specifically foreseen, thought about how much authority to delegate to the president, put limits on that. And so the idea that a general conferral of authority would...
Something can be large and serious and not rise to the level of extraordinary, unusual, and unforeseeable. Right?
Correct. Okay. But if it is large and serious, whenever, Section 122 says whenever there's a large and serious balance of payments deficit, it sets forth the power. So
couldn't Congress have attributed greater powers when there's an emergency and it's unforeseen? Couldn't they have envisioned that the president would be greater powers in those circumstances than when it's just large and serious?
Sure, they could have, but if you look at these two statutes together, there is no indication that that's what Congress was doing. Congress was providing authority for the president to deal with any large and serious trade deficit in Section 122, and it was providing...
Isn't there a distinction between the trade deficit and consequences of a trade deficit, and that the statute could still have some role in play? For instance, we know we had a trade deficit forever. 122 is the main test to deal with that if you want to. But what if all of a sudden
an entire industry that's integral to national security collapses overnight. That's been building a long time, but the emergency event is, for instance, chips. Let's just say there's a certain chip that all of our military computers and planes and everything need. Our industry completely collapses and it goes overseas. Couldn't you use IEEPA to solve that problem?
You might be able to, although I should point out there are other tariff statutes that might cover exactly that. Section 232, if it's a military issue. Section 201, if it's hurting domestic industry. So we'd have to examine exactly what that is. But the point is, I think in your hypothetical, we're not talking about tariffs that are justified as a response to persistent trade deficits. That's exactly what the president invoked here. And so, yes, maybe there are other things that the president could have done and other reasons the president could have given, and we could examine those. But when the president is imposing tariffs to address a large and serious trade deficit, that's exactly what Section 122 is addressing. Judge Toronto, you were asking about the record on summary judgment about manufacturing in particular.
Just a procedural posture, whether the parties agreed that the resolution of this motion, the motions only came from your side, yours actual, yours by attribution.
Right.
But there was no government motion for summary judgment.
Correct.
Whether everybody agreed that this was the complete record on which this case was going to be decided in favor of one or the other. Because
that's correct.
Reversing ruling a summary judgment for the plaintiff doesn't do that by itself.
And the record on summary judgment includes, you can see this appendix, pages 215 to 219, undisputed evidence that the state submitted, that the government did not submit any evidence contradicting this, specifically addressing manufacturing. So if Your Honor is interested in what the evidence was on manufacturing,
I'm sorry, I'm just asking this procedural, boring procedural question. We have a grant of a motion for summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff.
Correct.
If we reverse that without saying anything else, it's an open question whether the government is entitled to judgment in its favor. Ordinarily, it wouldn't be without just because
if you reversed on the ground that there were genuine issues of material fact, then yes, I suppose further proceedings would be required. But the evidence in this case was undisputed. We submitted a fair bit of evidence, including expert evidence, and the government didn't rebut any of it. So that taking that evidence, even in the light most favorable to the government,
but your arguments in your brief to us are devoted to just the more narrow question of trade deficits alone as not amounting to an unusual and extraordinary threat.
Correct.
You didn't comment at all about all the other things the executive order identified, including the hollowing out of the manufacturing base, threat to national security, supply chain disruptions, everything else that it talked about.
And that's because, you can look at the executive order itself. The justification, the unusual and extraordinary threat that it is identifying is what it calls persistent trade deficits. Everything else that's discussed there is either mentioned as a cause or an effect. But it's the trade deficits that are what the president was claiming as the justification for the action.
Is that the only fair reading of the executive orders, though? Can it be read as there are some recent consequences, some recent effects of the long and persistent trade deficit that now are unusual and extraordinary, and that's what the president's acting on? Why would that, in your view, not be a fair reading?
Well, you can look at the title itself. There are those causes and effects are mentioned in about a sentence in the executive order. But the entire weight of what the executive order is discussing from the title down is the trade deficits.
What happens when you add trade and services to the equation? This whole thing we've been talking about, trade and goods,
right.
There's been an exclusion of trade and services.
There's still a deficit. The balance of trade is the largest component of what would be the current account, which would include the services and other transfers like that. There is still and has been historically a significant deficit. So, but
Counsel, you said that you thought that the effects were mentioned in about a sentence. I don't know if you and I are reading a totally different executive order. Are you reading 15041, the Federal Register site, executive order 14257? Because it goes on for paragraph after paragraph. I see one that talks about U.S. production, one that talks about military equipment, one that talks about how U.S. security is compromised by foreign producers of goods, one that talks about how the decline of U.S. manufacturing capacity threatens the U.S. economy in other ways, including the loss of manufacturing jobs. How does that not constitute what the president is expressly saying is an extraordinary threat? He uses the word threat, for goodness sakes.
Well,
how could you stand here and say to me that the president said it's all about the deficit and it's one throwaway sentence at most in this whole order about the rest of these things constituting a threat?
The
executive order is clear.
So I am looking at section one of that executive order where the president actually declares the emergency, and it's the emergency arising from conditions reflected in large and persistent annual U.S. trade good deficits. And I believe that that's the operative language. That is what is determining what is, because under IEPA, it's very important to know what exactly is the threat that the president is addressing, because IEPA says that the president can.
Okay, well, how about we go to section one where he actually declares the national emergency, which is on page 15044 of the Federal Register. I've declared a national emergency arising from the conditions reflected in a large and persistent trade deficit. But he goes on to say, this deficit reflects asymmetries in trade that have contributed to the atrophy of domestic production capacity, especially in the U.S. manufacturing and defense industrial bases. These asymmetries, I mean, wouldn't I actually look at the sections, which is where he says, for these reasons, I hereby declare an order? Wouldn't that seem like a relevant part as opposed to sentence number one, which just is in the background? Wouldn't you actually go to, for these reasons, I declare an order? Wouldn't that seem relevant? And doesn't he clearly articulate where he declares and orders all of these things in exasperative detail? Compromised military readiness. That bothers me. I'm a little concerned about compromised military readiness. How about you?
We all should be should be concerned about that.
Well,
and the president,
what he's saying is the unusual and extraordinary threat.
Well,
how could you say a single sentence in the beginning? Did you maybe overstate it? Do you want to walk it back?
Justice
Gorsuch would invite people to do on occasion.
Sure, I will walk back that it was a single sentence. But I think if you read this, the fairest reading of this executive order is that it is about the large and persistent trade deficits. And I should say the federal government, I don't think, argued to the contrary in the Court of International Trade. So if that's their argument here, the argument's not preserved.
Well, when they say large and persistent, it's followed by which have grown by over 40% in the past 5 years alone. There's also a reference to the fact that when President Trump left office, there was a trade surplus in agricultural products. But today that surplus has vanished. And now there's a deficit-protected $49 billion annual agricultural trade deficit. That's all included in the executive order, right?
And that is the kind of situation that Section 122 provides authority for the president to address. And again, if you don't agree with that argument, you don't have to agree with that argument in order to rule that the reciprocal tariffs are unlawful, either because they exceed what regulate means in this context, or because IEPA just doesn't allow tariffs at all.
Can I ask you what I asked Mr. Katyal, which
sure.
is what will regulate importation does in the statute if it doesn't cover tariffs?
Well, there are a lot of other ways that you can regulate importations. I mean, it would depend on the nature of the threat, but if you imagine... maybe. As opposed to an ad valorem tax, maybe, although I think that would be tricky. But I think what it clearly would cover, for example, would be, suppose there's an agricultural pest that's been identified that's coming into this country through imports and is threatening our agriculture. The president could regulate import.
That's covered under different portions because it includes regulate. An alternative verb is prevent or prohibit
sure.
any importation. So that could be covered by the other provisions.
If the president wanted to prevent or prohibit, but if what the president wanted to do was require additional inspections or irradiations or quarantines, those are all things that I think would most naturally fit into regulate. And again,
those would be in connection with those additional inspections.
I think that would be hard. I think that would be a harder case for us. And I think that if it wasn't an ad valorem, but if it was a fee that was tied to the actual cost of providing that service, I still think when you're talking about a statute that is authorizing the federal government to raise revenue, we normally would require, you know, something clearly authorizing that. But the statute does talk about licensing.
In a lot of like user fee cases where it's proportional versus, is essentially an ad tax.
It might be. And what I can say is that if the fee that the president was imposing for that was, you know, something that, like these, you know, affects trillions of dollars in trade and fundamentally remakes the economy, then we would still have a major questions doctrine question about, you know, can you really stretch regulate that far? But if it was a small fee that was proportioned to the actual cost of providing the service, that might be permissible. That's not what we have here.
If the president believed there was some kind of public health emergency and needed to shut down all the borders, would AIBA authorize the president to block all foreign imports for a period of time?
Potentially, if that would deal with the threat. I think I would need to know a little bit more about exactly what the threat was.
So that's a much more dramatic order than the kind of order we have here.
Well, it's an order of a very different kind. Raising revenue is fundamentally different from regulating commerce in the way that Your Honor is describing. And I think it's important not to conflate those. Those are two different powers under the Constitution. Going back to Gibbons versus Ogden, the Supreme Court has recognized that they're different. And they're different because, you know, the power to raise revenue is a power that's reserved to Congress. It was a power that was of particular concern to our founders. You know,
but that's not the entire purpose of tariffs. I mean, you got to read the Hampton case where exactly that issue was before the court. And the court said, yes, you can have tariffs to raise revenues, but you can also have tariffs to address other problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think my point is that actions that raise revenue, whether or not they're accomplishing something else, are in our constitutional structure fundamentally separate from actions that regulate in other ways. And that's really only the only point that we're making, is that if you have a statute that governs one, you would be looking for something in the context of the statute to suggest that Congress meant both.
Can I focus you on the trafficking tariffs? Because
yes.
You're challenging those, right?
Yes.
If I were to agree with the Court of International Trade that regulate allows some tariffing, but I didn't agree with it that there's a problem with the deals with limitation, would I have to reverse the CIT on the trafficking tariffs, on their validity, or do you have some other argument as to why they would nonetheless be invalid if I don't buy the deals with issue?
If you don't buy the deals with argument and you don't buy the argument that AIPA doesn't allow tariffs at all, I think, was that also the premise of your question?
That's the premise.
Yes. Then I think what we still have an argument, I think, along the lines of some of Judge Hughes's questions, that the term regulate still only connotes modest modifications. I mean, the federal government's favorite synonym for regulate is adjust, and they want to invoke.
And what would make the trafficking tariffs, in your view, not modest or not merely an adjustment?
Because they're not, for example, like the tariffs at issue in Yoshida that were strictly bounded by the column 2 amounts that Congress had previously.
It's something about the rates?
Yes.
And the duration.
And the rates and the duration and the scope. I mean, adjust the plain, we cite this on page 17 of our brief, Webster's dictionary definitions that explain that adjust has a connotation of modest modifications that bring something into harmony. You know, this is a lot like Biden versus Nebraska, as Mr. Katyal was explaining. You know, a statute that said that the president could waive or modify any statutory provision didn't mean that the president could cancel student loans, because that's too big an action. I think you could make the same argument here and reach the same result here, even if you didn't accept either of those other arguments.
Well, what if we conclude we're living in a Yoshida world?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there was some form of legislative ratification here of that this language, regulate importation, includes what Yoshida said in its interpretation of that language as permitting authorizing tariffs. And we look at Yoshida and it it said at the very end of the opinion that this is an incredibly broad statutory authorization that Congress has given the president, and may be unwise, and it may be very dangerous if it gets into the wrong hands, but this is Congress's choice. And so I guess the concern I have here is your attempt to narrow and characterize Yoshida as only some lightweight version of imposing tariffs and surcharges, as opposed to understanding the term regulate importation as just including the power to apply tariffs, period.
Well, I think Yoshida is much more helpful to us than it is to the federal government in this case.
Well, I know you think that, but did you just hear what I said?
Yes, exactly. And what Yoshida says repeatedly is that it is not sanctioning an unbounded exercise of tariffing authority. And whether it does that because of the constitutional concerns or just because of reading the statute, the net result is exactly the same thing, which is that Yoshida's interpretation of TWIA doesn't allow the breadth of authority that would be required to sustain the tariffs here. And if Congress intended to ratify that, then there's every reason to think that Congress intended to ratify all of that. So then
how would you say in a sentence what it ratified?
On the assumption that Congress ratified Yoshida, it ratified the holding that before Section 122 was enacted, TWIA allowed the president to impose modest bounded temporary tariffs that were within the statutory framework that existed, but did not sanction unbounded permanent tariffs that were outside of that.
Is the key the language that you said, that it has to be within the schedule that Congress has enacted?
I think that might be part of it. I mean, you know, there are sentences you can pull out from Yoshida that I think point in different ways, but that was certainly one of the factors that I think caused the court in Yoshida to think that the surcharge at issue in that case was permissible.
Do you understand enough about how Column 2 worked in 1971 and works today to provide some clarification of exactly what we should think about the language that the 10% surcharge, if it went over a Column 2 rate, was by the terms of the 1971 proclamation limited to the Column 2 rate, which at least today applies to, what, 4 countries in the world?
Right.
And in 1971, I think sort of nominally to maybe 8, but the same treatment was maybe accorded to about a dozen other countries in the interpretive note.
Yeah, I don't know how many.
I want to understand how this what to make of this Column 2 thing, which are rates that are, I think, set just for certain countries. So it's not like for, I don't know, UK or a country that's not on the list, that there is a Column 2 rate specified by Congress.
So my understanding is that Column 2 is for countries for which we did not have normal trade relations. And so it was sort of the residual of, these are the tariffs that would apply to the whole world, except that we have normal trade relations with most of the world, and so we have agreed to reduce those tariffs. So I think what Yoshida saw as the significance in Column 2...
Are all of the Column 2 rates higher than all of the non-Column 2 rates?
I don't know the answer to that. I think they're typically...
Isn't that kind of a necessary assumption, some idea that a set of rates that applies to a tiny number of countries reflects a judgment that for the rest of the world, that's as high as Congress is willing to go?
And
that was true in 1971. Is it true today?
I think it is still typically true. I can't say that I can...
Two rates come into existence and by who?
Sorry?
How do Column 2 rates come into existence and by whom?
By the same way that any other tariff.
That's not
would, okay. So I think they have typically, historically been enacted by Congress. Congress has, of course, sometimes delegated authority to the president to make adjustments or to other executive officials to make adjustments to the tariff schedule. I don't know if that is specific to column two or not, you know, if there are specific delegations about column two. But historically these were either enacted by Congress originally or they were enacted by Congress in ratifying trade deals. I think ratifying trade deals is probably not going to affect column two either. So I think you would probably have to go back a ways to find the origins of the column two rates. I can't say that I know that every single one of them is higher than the column one rate, but I think logically that would make some sense.
They're not. Coffee is zero for everybody and has been since 1970. Congress likes its coffee, so they want to be able to get imported coffee and have zero tax. Column one or column two, coffee is zero.
And there are certainly many lines in the harmonized tariff schedule where column one and column two are the same. And it's either because it's all free or because it's all very low or it's all very specific. But there are still column two rates that are, 4 cents per kilogram of beef and things like that that really don't, I think, reflect how most of our modern tariffs work.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gutman.
Thank you.
Give the government all 10 minutes of its rebuttal time because we went over with both of the appellees.
Thank you. Judge Chen, you brought up the end of the Yoshida opinion, and I think that's a fitting place to end the argument today because I think,
so we're going to just leave in a minute? No. We're ending the argument. You heard him.
Give me 10 more minutes. Oh. I think the end of the opinion informs how a future court should review a future president's use of emergency authorities to impose tariffs. And the court said at page 583, when Congress uses far-reaching words in delegating authority to the president in the area of foreign relations, courts must assume, unless there is a specific contrary showing elsewhere in the statute or in the legislative history, that the legislators contemplate that the president may and will make full use of that power in any manner not inconsistent with the provisions or purposes of the act, end quote. And so that's the point I was trying to make earlier, is that Congress didn't intend to confine the president's use of IEEPA to exactly the same facts as Yoshida. Instead, in the context of an emergency statute, Congress intends for those statutes to be interpreted very broadly, and the court has to look to specific limits in the statute itself.
Is that really how we interpret statutes anymore? I mean, don't we just start with the text of regulate and go from there? It seems like you're having us start somewhere else.
Well, I just stuck your opinion on solar energy. I think properly framed the question under the clear misconception standard, and that's the standard that applies here, and that standard is well-rooted in the Supreme Court's precedents, recognizing that in the foreign affairs and national security context, courts give broad deference to the president and interpret statutes broadly because the intention is that Congress understands we need to give the president broad discretion in the national
security. So you think that standard survives Loper, right?
Absolutely. I think Justice Kavanaugh explained why in his consumers research concurring opinion. He explained, look, the major questions doctrine applies in the domestic context, but it doesn't apply in the foreign relations context because going back to Curtis Wright, Marshall Field, Dames and Moore, the Supreme Court has always given the president a wide berth and broad deference.
Most circuits have disagreed with that, right?
Not in the context of specific delegations to the president in the national security context.
Could I understand exactly what's going on here? I have some familiarity with the harmonized tariff schedule, and I decided to go look at that. And if I understand the executive order, what it does is as to virtually every rate set by the harmonized tariff schedules, now under reciprocal tariffs, there will be 10% added to that. So it's a wholesale revision of the scheme that Congress enacted in the harmonized tariff schedule, correct?
There is a modification, yes, of the harmonized tariff schedule.
But it's just hard for me to see that Congress intended to give the president in IEEPA the wholesale authority to throw out the tariff schedule that Congress had adopted after years of careful work and revise every one of these tariff rates. It's really kind of asking for an extraordinary change to the whole approach of tariffs reflected in the harmonized tariff statute, right?
Disagree, Your Honor, because this is a broad statute that delegates the president broad authority.
I didn't ask whether the statute is a broad statute. I said that the effect of it is a broad revision, really tossing out the harmonized tariff schedule and substituting a new schedule with rates set by the president. That's what's going on here, right?
That's what's going on in the context of an emergency. And if Congress disagrees with that action, of course Congress can step in and check the president. And I think the question for the court is whether what the president did contravened any specific limit in the statute itself, in IEEPA, the statute he invoked. And that's what Yoshida says at the end of the opinion the court should focus on. Not only do you start from the presumption that Congress intended to delegate broad authority, but you look to the act itself. Did the president violate any specific limitation in IEEPA itself? And we've talked about those limits today. They have not carried their burden to show that the president violated a specific limitation in the statute itself. I know it may be hard to believe that the president may have this power.
Counsel, wouldn't maybe your argument possibly be that Nixon also adopted a 10% tariff in Yoshida on absolutely everything and against every country? Now, mind you, he bounded it in for every single category to the column 2 rates, but to the extent that somebody is saying wholesale, wasn't Nixon's proclamation equally wholesale in terms of the number of countries it impacted and the number of goods it impacted?
Yes, it was an extraordinary invocation of tariff authority as well under an emergency statute.
It was temporary, right?
And it was temporary, and presumptively...
But it also only applied in the situations where the president had increased the rates and he was now decreasing them, right?
Well, I don't think it's right to think of Yoshida as only affirming and allowing future presidents.
No, that's not the question. The question is, what did Nixon do? That's what Nixon did, right? I mean, he said where the president exercised the authority to increase the rates, he was exercising the authority to decrease them, right?
Right. He was taking a specific action. The fact that the president's action in this case may be broader than President Nixon's action doesn't make this action illegal unless the plaintiffs can point to any specific violation of the statute. And they haven't here. The statute has specific limits. The plaintiffs haven't carried their burden to show that the president violated or exceeded those limits. We come back to the text of the statute. Again, IEEPA is an extraordinary delegation of power, and the delegation here is to regulate importation. And
Can I shift you to the constitutional question? I have some trouble with the idea that the courts and public can see the boundaries component of a recently reiterated standard for unconstitutional delegation, and how that can apply if the substantive standards of the delegation are not enforceable in some way. If there's reason to think that merely procedural standards don't count, that's case that says that very much in passing, but it does say that. So I'm looking just at the substantive standards, the unusual and extraordinary character, the kind of for this purpose and no other, deal with. And so I address that. I mean, that seems to me a big problem with your broad contention that those substantive standards are not judicially reviewable. And I'm interested in, if they are reviewable, what does the case law really say about which particular presidential judgments should be deferred to, as opposed to everything the president says should be deferred to, which I don't think the case law says?
To take the latter question first, the case law says that the president's discretionary decisions are not reviewable, and that comes from a case called Dalton versus Specter.
Right, but you can't tell what's discretionary until you've figured out what the meaning of the particular statutory standard is and what the facts are. That is, what the bounds of the discretion are.
Well, I think the discretionary decisions here are set forth in Section 1701, declaring a national emergency, identifying threat.
Put aside the declaration of emergency. I will spot you the unreviewability of that. But the unusual and extraordinary character. The other side clearly thinks that has some content because they say, we've proven this is usual and ordinary. And you can't say that if it's completely meaningless. So that's intelligible in at least some sense. Why isn't that, well, why can't that be reviewed? If the president, you know, asserted a fact that was actually disprovable, as opposed to a prediction or value judgment or a policy assessment about how to evaluate things, but an actual provable or disprovable fact, why would that not be legitimately reviewed under the deferential approach in foreign affairs?
So I think the court addressed this in Florsheim at 796. The court said his motives, his reasoning, his findings of fact requiring the action, and his judgment are immune from judicial scrutiny. That decision is consistent with a long line of cases saying that presidential discretionary decisions are not reviewable. But what you can review are whether the president contravened any limits on his authority in Section 1702. Did he regulate importation? Did he contravene any of the four specific limits in 1702B? So there is a role for the court to play, but the primary role is for Congress to check the president if there's an abuse of the IEEPA tariff authority. And so,
and what aspect of constitutional non-delegation law says that what you think remains of judicial review is sufficient to check the president or the delegatee whether that person has stayed within the boundaries, which is the phrase repeated several times in communication consumers research drawn from earlier cases.
Right. So I think Justice Kavanaugh and Consumers Research and Curtis Wright recognize a lesser standard for the non-delegation doctrine in the foreign affairs context. But even under the non-delegation doctrine intelligible principle test, you've got two prongs, right? One, did Congress identify the general... I see my time is up. Congress has to identify the general policy, which they have in Section 1701. And then the second question is, what are the boundaries? Did Congress identify limits on that authority? 1702B provides the limits on that authority, and the court can check that, review that.
Okay. I thank all counsel. This case is taken under submission.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.